Hello, you're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips. Today, an unpopular free trade agreement in Taiwan.
Student protesters are continuing to occupy Taiwan's parliament in a bid to thwart government efforts to ratify a contentious trade agreement with China.
Since Tuesday, thousands of Taiwanese have been surrounding and occupying the Legislative Yuan in Taipei, after legislators from the ruling Kuomintang Party expedited the review process of a services trade pact with China.
This month, the Australian government announced a free trade agreement with Japan, signed one with South Korea, and undertook to negotiate one with China. None of these caused much of a stir, unlike the recent announcement of a free trade agreement between China and Taiwan, which led last month to the occupation of Taiwan's parliament by student protesters and street demonstrations by well over 100,000 people, protests known as the Sunflower Student Movement. Today on Rear Vision, we'll find out the background to yet another in a seemingly endless stream of popular protests. The activists in Taiwan are opposed to the signing of the Cross-Strait Service Trade Agreement by Taiwan's ruling party, the KMT. Dr. Zhang Minhua, visiting research fellow at the East Asia Institute at the National University of Singapore, says the services deal covers everything from banks to hairdressers.
According to the Cross-Service Trade Agreement, Taiwan will have to open 64 sectors in services to China. At the same time, China will have to open 80 sectors in services to Taiwan. There are a variety of sectors included. The large ones such as car rental, printing, advertising, hospital, financial services, and the small ones like laundry, restaurants, hair and cosmetics and so on.
And why was this agreement controversial?
The agreement is very controversial in Taiwan because, first, from an economic point of view, this agreement is not expected to benefit a lot to Taiwan's microeconomy. Many people say that services accounted for nearly 70% of Taiwan's GDP, so Taiwan needs to sign an agreement with China. But they ignore the driver behind Taiwan's economic growth is actually the net export in goods, not the net export in services. For example, last year, Taiwan's net export in goods is about $33 billion, but the net export in service is only $9 billion. So actually, the free trade agreement in goods is much more important than the free trade agreement in services between Taiwan and China, if the government really want to stimulate Taiwan's economic growth. So it is a very strange arrangement that the government put the FTA in services before the FTA in goods. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that the government claimed that this agreement will offer Taiwanese companies to take advantage of China's booming market, but it failed to explain clearly what to do with the small and the medium enterprises who have no capacity to invest in China. Those SME in Taiwan, they can be easily merged by the large Chinese companies, the Chinese state-owned enterprises. Those Chinese SOE actually have very close political relations with the Communist Party of China. So when those SOE, they come to invest in Taiwan, at the same time, behind those potentially large investment, there is a very strong political purpose. So if we do get the slogan from the students, the slogan is withdraw the service trade agreement and protect Taiwan's democracy. And the third point, the third controversial point is that the process of the trade negotiation with China was not transparent. The agreement was signed on 21 June last year without having enough consultation with the experts in academic or in business areas. And there was no much information leaked out before the agreement was announced. So it was criticized as under the table deal between the KMT party in Taiwan and the CPC party in China. So because of the pressure from the society, President Ma Ying-jeou then agreed to examine the agreement close by close, but he also insisted at the same time that this agreement cannot be revised, even with one word, and it must be ratified before this June in the parliament. But the problem is, if no revision is possible, then the examination in the parliament is like just going through the process.
J. Bruce Jacobs is a professor of Asian languages and studies at Monash University in Melbourne.
Now, many people in Taiwan feel that this was not properly negotiated, looking sufficiently at Taiwan's interests. For example, even though more areas are opened up for Taiwan than they are for China, China has, in every case it's been opened up, has full access to all of Taiwan, whereas at least in some cases, Taiwan has only Fujian province, which is the province opposite Taiwan, but not the whole of China. There's some other issues too. For example, both sides have opened up, according to this agreement, publishing industry. But in Taiwan, publishing is free, and in China, it's extraordinarily controlled. So again, that's not fair. And there was very little consultation within Taiwan before it was negotiated. So there's not people so much opposed to the agreement, but feeling that it needs to be amended and renegotiated.
Shane Lee, a political science professor at Changchun University in Taiwan, says that there's no way Taiwan's smaller companies can compete with China's large ones.
China's economy has become such that they have large corporations backed by the government. But Taiwanese economic structure is such that mostly are small and medium businesses. They are very small in scale. For example, a company has only about 100 or 200 workers. But in China, they are all conglomerates, very large. Small business and medium business cannot compete with the large corporations because they would offer cheaper prices. And so in the end, the Taiwanese company will be killed by all these big businesses. In theory, you know, the Taiwanese business can enter some of the areas that were not open to the Taiwanese businessmen before. For example, they would open up the Taiwanese banks to open branches in China. But economists say that even though they open up these opportunities for Taiwanese banks, but actually you cannot compete with the Chinese banks. In theory, it's an opportunity, but actually you cannot be successful there because most of the Chinese banks are public banks, so to speak, government-backed banks. They're much larger in scale. For example, one bank in China is the equivalent of all the banks combined. So how can you compete in China with this large bank? But on the other hand, when we open up to the Chinese bankers or Chinese services industry, because they are large scale, they can beat up all the Taiwanese small and medium-sized businesses.
Mari Alice McLean-Dreyfus is a postgraduate student at the Australian National University and has just come back from a year studying and working in Taiwan. She says that although the demonstrations were led by students, their actions were widely supported.
The majority of them were students and NGOs. So in recent years in Taiwan, there's been a lot of student protests, youth protests, and it was all organised through social media. So this latest one was also mostly students. However, as it went on, it united the whole of Taiwan. So there were old people, young people, and across all the different ethnic divides in Taiwan as well. It was called the Sunflower Movement. There's a few stories how it got the name. There was one story where it said a florist wanted to give lilies to the protesters, but they didn't have any lilies in stock, so it gave them sunflowers instead. And when the protesters saw the sunflowers, they thought it was quite apt because sunflowers go towards the sun. Perhaps they could also shed light on the dark process of the agreement.
Taiwan, officially the Republic of China, is a little bigger than half the size of Tasmania, with roughly the same population as Australia. The island lies about 180 kilometres off the southeastern coast of mainland China. After the communist victory in the Chinese Civil War and the establishment of the People's Republic of China in 1949, Chiang Kai-shek, the leader of the Chinese nationalists, the Kuomintang or Kuomintang, took his government to Taiwan and declared Taipei the temporary capital of the Republic of China. The Kuomintang continued to claim sovereignty over all China, while on the mainland, the victorious communists claimed they ruled the only China, including Taiwan. Denny Roy is the author of Taiwan, A Political History.
The government that moved its central headquarters from mainland China to Taiwan in 1949 imposed what could be best described as a military dictatorship. Taiwan was to be a temporary resting place while the nationalist regime gathered strength, preparation for going back to the mainland and reconquering the rest of China from the communist regime. So from Taiwan's point of view, not only were they not given their own political space, but they're forced to harbor this additional layer of government with political agenda that, to say the least, they were not interested in. It was about a 4-to-1 ratio of Taiwanese to mainlanders. So the mainlanders were clearly a minority government, a minority faction. Nonetheless, they controlled most of the not only important political positions, but most of the desirable positions in industry, education, and so on. The Taiwanese identity, the Taiwanese political agenda was simply not allowed to be openly practiced. In fact, even speaking negatively toward the government's agenda or speaking in terms of a distinct Taiwan identity could get those activists imprisoned or, in some cases, summarily executed.
In 1971, the People's Republic took China's seat at the UN, and during that decade, as the West began to normalize relations with communist China, relationships between Taiwan and countries like the US and Australia became complicated.
The government of Chiang Kai-shek insisted there was only one China. There could be no accommodation between the communists and his government in Taiwan. So when the governments around in the Western world, primarily in the early 1970s, Canada, Australia, Japan, wanted to recognize China, the Taiwan government broke relations with them. Now, the Japanese actually set up a very interesting precedent where they established relations with China, but they had informal, officially unofficial relations with Taiwan. And this set the precedent, and the Americans did the same thing. We've done the same thing in Australia. The Americans now have an American Institute in Taiwan, and in Australia we have an Australian office. And these are officially unofficial diplomatic relations. So the government people would say, no, we don't have formal diplomatic relations, but in fact we do.
After the death of Chiang Kai-shek in 1975, his son, Chiang Ching-kuo, became president. During the early 1980s and early 90s, Taiwan's political system began to undergo gradual liberalization, especially under Lee Teng-hui, who succeeded Chiang Ching-kuo, ultimately becoming Taiwan's first popularly elected president.
President Lee Teng-hui was a Taiwanese, and he had been made vice president when Chiang Ching-kuo became president. And Chiang Ching-kuo didn't pick Lee Teng-hui to be his successor, but Lee Teng-hui, I guess you could say, was a very wily, competent person. And he pushed very hard, and he worked very hard with the opposition at the time and with progressive elements within the Kuomintang, and he moved Taiwan towards democracy. There had been movements before of people pushing for more rights under the dictatorship, but Lee Teng-hui really pushed hard, and so there was a combination of democratization and Taiwanization at the same time. And in the early 90s, where there was a big extra-constitutional meeting that took place, there was discussion about how Taiwan should reform. And there was a big debate about whether the president should be popularly elected or not. But within a year or two, everyone agreed. And by 1996, there was the popular election of the president.
Martial law had been lifted in 87, Chiang Ching-kuo had died. Lee Teng-hui became the president. And in the early 90s, 92, especially 91, 92, there was constitutional reform.
Dr. Mark Harrison is a senior lecturer in Chinese at the University of Tasmania.
Chiang Ching-kuo had also done a lot to reform the KMT, to give it roots in Taiwan, and that process was realized in the 90s. And so the KMT gave up its claim over China, that it was the legitimate government of all of China. So that sort of absurdist aspect of the KMT was finally put to bed in the early 90s. It was also a period of tremendous economic growth in Taiwan, a real boom period where the economy sort of shifted from its kind of low-wage, light manufacturing economy to a much more modern economy, a high-tech economy. So it's a period of tremendous confidence in Taiwan. It was also after the Tiananmen Square incident in 1989, where the Taiwanese really began to understand that they didn't want a future with China, that they had sufficient economic power and material power in order to actually make their own future.
During the period of democratization, Taiwanese culture and history were promoted, in contrast to the previous KMT insistence on Chinese identity.
It was only when Taiwan began to democratize in the very late 1980s and early 1990s that Taiwan also began a process of decolonization. And the issues that have been raised in Taiwan are, who are we, for example? And this is a big issue in Taiwan. In a similar way, like it was an issue in Australia too, especially under the Labor governments of Hawke and Keating. There was an emphasis on Australians as being different from Britain. In Taiwan, that same sort of a cultural change has taken place. So whereas now more than half the people in Taiwan identify as Taiwanese and not as Chinese, and all the polls show this, there's been this sort of huge change in terms of who are we in terms of China.
You're listening to Rear Vision with Keri Phillips on RN, online, on mobile and by podcast. Today we're looking at the relationship between Taiwan and China after street demonstrations and the occupation of Taiwan's parliament over a free trade agreement between the two countries. The relationship between the People's Republic of China and the issues of Taiwan independence and Chinese reunification dominate Taiwanese politics. Taiwan has two main political parties, the old pro-unification KMT and the Democratic Progressive Party, associated with Taiwanese identity and independence.
There are two main political forces. There's the Nationalist Party, or the Kuomintang, which is the ruling party right now, and it's sort of the head of the blue forces. And then there's the Democratic Progressive Party, which is sort of the head of the green forces, and they're in the opposition right now. The Democratic Progressive Party was the old opposition to the old dictatorship. They won the presidency against a split opposition in 2000, and they won re-election in 2004. But the Mao government won election in 2008. So it went from blue government under Lee Teng-hui, but a very Taiwanese blue government, to green government under Chen Shui-bian, and then under Ma Ying-jeou it's gone back to blue government in a more conservative way.
In 2000, the DPP won the presidency, ending the KMT's continuous control of the government, and the party led a minority government until 2008, when the KMT was returned to office and its chairman, Ma Ying-jeou, was elected president. Jiang Min-hua says that the Taiwanese system of government allows President Ma too much power.
That means, as the president, he has the absolute administrative power. But he also controls the parliament indirectly through the parliament, because the KMT party is the majority in the parliament right now. So that means the parliament in Taiwan is no longer a place that represents people's concern. Instead, it is a place that's used to fulfill the administration's policy, which is connected to the KMT party's political interest. And that interest, that political party's interest, is tightly connected with Taiwanese large companies who have a lot of business in China. And that is also why the protesters, they choose to occupy the parliament, because the parliament, they think that it is no longer functioning as it should be anymore. And some KMT people, they understand the anger from the society, from the students, and they also concern the forthcoming local election at the end of this November. So we can see that there will be some division inside the KMT. And DPP, another opposition party in Taiwan, DPP is also hurt by the student movement, because those students during the movement, they are well organized and they perform very well, and their appeal can receive a widespread support from the society. So these students, they have much stronger capacity to mobilize the people to go on the street. And so compared with DPP, those students unions and they work with social groups, those group of people, they are actually acting like a real strong opposition party in Taiwan right now.
The protesters ended their parliamentary sit-in after the legislative speaker, Wang Jinping, promised to postpone a review of the trade pact until legislation monitoring all cross-strait agreements has been passed. Meanwhile, the two major parties haggle over whether to ratify the cross-strait service trade agreement item by item or by a vote on the whole package. Although the agreement, which was signed in June last year, has not yet been approved by MPs, the KMT has a majority in the legislative yuan. China is Taiwan's biggest trading partner, and in recent years, ties between the two have improved. Since the current KMT government won office in 2008, China and Taiwan have been negotiating to re-establish links in transportation, commerce and communications.
There has been. I think lately there's been more and more. So since Ma Ying-jeou came to power in 2008, there's been 25 agreements signed between China and Taiwan. So I think in recent years, there's been more and more economic integration between the two sides. I think now 85% of Taiwan foreign investment goes to China. So that's quite a large percentage. Before that, when the nationalists first came to Taiwan, there wasn't much going on between the two purely because each side thought that they were China. It's more since Taiwan's democratization and since they lost their seat in the UN that the two sides have started having more interactions together. Yeah, I think when Taiwan lost its seat at the UN, that was really the catalyst for Taiwan realizing that their attempt to retake the mainland was futile. Now things have changed a lot. Taiwan knows that there's no way it will ever retake the mainland, and I think they're focusing more on building their own country and their own economic system.
Basically, because the Chinese keep saying Taiwan belongs to us, and the people in Taiwan don't agree with that, it's made things difficult. In fact, earlier on, there were some discussions. So in 1992, there were discussions on the early democratic government under President Lee Teng-hui. There were some discussions in Singapore. It's actually in 1993 were the main discussions. The Chinese were unhappy with the way Lee Teng-hui was doing things. And under the Chen Shui-bian government, there were also a series of agreements. For example, there were agreements to set up flights between China and Taiwan. The Chinese then decided they didn't want to give the Chen Shui-bian government credit for this, so they waited until the Ma Ying-jeou government was elected, and now there's lots and lots of flights. So the main problem that Taiwan has is I think people in Taiwan, irrespective of their political perspectives, are prepared to have good relations with China, but the Chinese aren't always willing to do that. And the sort of pace of relations between Taiwan and China run at the pace that the Chinese are willing to make.
China and Taiwan are holding their first official government talks since the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949. A delegation from Taiwan is in Nanjing for 4 days of negotiations aimed at building trust between the two sides. China still regards Taiwan as part of its territory, while Taiwan has never formally renounced its claim to be the proper ruler of mainland China. Previous talks between the two have been conducted through quasi-official organisations.
It's impossible to imagine in the past that we could sit here and meet today. We must have some imagination if we want to resolve some difficulties, not just for this meeting, but a bigger imagination for cross-strait development in the future.
Despite the apparent thawing of cross-strait relations, there's still an enormous amount of suspicion on the Taiwanese side. Is China using economic muscle rather than military force to annex its small neighbour?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of a fear. Even with Ma Ying-jeou, he said that he wasn't going to enter into any political talks with China, but he'd only enter into economic talks. But I think once you enter into economic talks, this can really only lead to political talks. And I think they kind of expect this as well. Perhaps their great plan is if Taiwan is so economically intertwined with China, then they'll have no choice but to become a part of China or become a province like Hong Kong. So I think there's a real fear that if the economic ties are too close, it's just one step on the slippery road down to unification.
This is actually not an economic agreement for China. This is a political agreement for China. Because if you look at the FTA between two countries, normally, FTA should be mutually beneficial to each other. But China claimed that it actually make more concession to Taiwan economically. If FTA is mutually beneficial to each other, then we can suspect that China must expect something in return. Why he makes so much concession to you? That's the problem. And the other concern is that Taiwan is not a service-oriented economy. Taiwan's economy is based on the manufacturing production. So for Taiwan, the most important thing is to sign the free trade in goods with China or with other countries. The FTA in goods is much more important. And Taiwan should sign the FTA with as many countries as possible in order to diversify the risk of putting all the eggs in only one blanket. But unfortunately, our government only focused on signing as many agreements as possible only with China. And that is very dangerous for Taiwan's economy.
How much does Taiwan need China economically?
Taiwan is a small economy without much natural resources. And Taiwan is very much dependent on external trade for its economic survival. So the best economic policy that Taiwan should have is to sign the FTA with as many countries as possible, just like Singapore. Taiwan should also upgrade the industry, increase the R&D investment, because the manufacturing production is still the key to sustain Taiwan's economy.
Well, see, people in Taiwan are not really against free trade. I mean, free trade is the trade, is a global trade. If you want to compete in a global market, you have to have this free trade. But in dealing with China, we have to be more careful. That's what the student said. Because China still is trying to annex Taiwan, it has never abandoned that ambition. So we are dealing with a hostile country, so to speak. We are not dealing with, say, Australia or New Zealand or Japan or the United States. We are on equal footing. But with China, it's different. It's a sort of an enemy country. At least that's the way they see us. They try to take over Taiwan all the time and never cease that ambition to take over Taiwan. So they ask the government to open up. You have to let us know what's in the deal with an enemy country like this. But my English government said, no, you just have to take whatever I give you. And some people suspect that Ma Ying-jeou is doing this because he's trying to have the so-called historical reputation that he is a peacemaker between the two sides. So eventually he is going to be recognized as a peacemaker of the Taiwan Strait, and perhaps he can get a Nobel Peace Prize for his own sake, not for the people of Taiwan.
Shane Lee, a political science professor at Chang Jung University in Taiwan. The other people you heard on Rear Vision today were Dr. Chiang Min Hua from the East Asia Institute at the National University of Singapore, Dr. Mark Harrison from the University of Tasmania, Mari Alice McLean-Dreyfus from the ANU, Bruce Jacobs, an emeritus professor from Monash University, and Denny Roy, the author of Taiwan, A Political History. Stephen Tilley is the sound engineer for today's program. Bye from Kerry Phillips.
Roger Savage began his career as a sound engineer in London, where he cut records with a virtual who's who of the British pop scene. In 1964, he moved to Melbourne and quickly established himself as one of the best in the business.
I got them to stomp on the floor during that chorus section, which gave it a big boost to the drums.
The sounds of Roger Savage on Rare Collections. Hear it anytime online.